Welcome to the fourth session of the What's the Economy For Anyway program. And this one is about what we call the longest run. If you were here the first day, you know that we started with the idea of Gifford Pinchot, the first director of the United States Forest Service, who said that the purpose of the economy should be the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. And then we talked about the greatest good as quality of life, and yesterday we talked about the greatest number as social justice and fairness, and today we're talking about the longest to run, sustainability. Some of you have asked about getting copies of the film or being on our list so you can get some notices of when we're things are coming out along with this, and also the book that Dave and I are writing, which comes out next spring. So I'm just going to pass out a sign-up sheet. If you're interested, just put down your name and email. We won't send you a lot of emails or bother you anyway. We're just going to show this chapter, and then, of course, I want to introduce Dave Batcher, the host of the film, who will be actually conducting this session on sustainability. He's the expert on this. He is an ecological economist and works with Earth Economics in Tacoma. He can tell you more about that. But let's get started with the film.
I study the impact of the economy on our planet. And I can tell you right now, that picture isn't pretty. Have you ever heard of your ecological footprint? In short, it's the share of the earth needed to provide your stuff and absorb your waste. Or mine. And we Americans fill the biggest shoes on the planet. You can figure out your footprint by taking a little test. You might be shocked at the result. Right. I use 10 acres, kind of like a typical European. There's a problem with that. If everyone's feet were as big as mine, that is, if everyone on Earth consumed like I do, we'd need two planets. That's the good news. Now here's the bad news. If you're a typical American, your ecological footprint is about 25 acres. We'd need five planets if everyone used as much as an American does. We use a quarter of the world's oil each year, more than a quarter of its resources. It all ends up as waste. Enough waste to fill a convoy of garbage trucks stretching halfway to the moon. Now consider what goes into making all those products of ours. Chemicals. Thousands of them. Most of them never tested for safety in combination with other chemicals. Some untested at all. We can't grow on like this. You know, economists talk a lot about capital. What they usually mean is built capital. The factories that make our products, for example, or the roads we drive on. But there are other kinds of capital. There's human capital. Our education, health, and skills. We know we're a little capital poor when it comes to those things. Then there's social capital. Our relationships, and families, and communities. We're coming up short there, too. The average American now has only two friends you can truly confide in. A quarter of us have none at all. And finally, there's natural capital. All the things we take from nature to sustain ourselves. That's worth a lot. If you haven't thought about how important natural capital is, try might test, what do you value more? Nature's gifts or stuff? You have a choice. You can have all Bill Gates' wealth, all $50 billion, or just one of nature's products, oxygen, which has no market value at all, no GDP value. Which would you choose? If you think you'd choose Bill's money, try holding your breath for 5 minutes. I love my laptop. So light, so much memory, so warm and fuzzy. And before the last time you get wrinkles, there'll be a new one on the market. Lighter, faster, sexier. That's the problem. We're changing models every year. Hurry up, will you? Patience is so yesterday. So, Americans throw millions of these things away every year. Hazardous waste, filled with toxic chemicals of all kinds, dropped in landfills or shipped overseas, polluting rivers, poisoning drinking water, out of sight, out of mind. And the GDP goes up. Now that's just the tip of the iceberg. We haven't even gotten to global warming. But Al Gore already told you about that, so I won't belabor the point. Longest run indeed, I'm feeling a little queasy.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here at Holden. And I, first of all, I wanted to just thank John. And this film has been one of the most fun projects I've worked on. And as an economist, most economists don't think the way John thinks. And so, when he, to say the least, but when he proposed this film, all these different issues, for instance, time work. You know, well, that's an area that's huge, just tremendously ignored by the economics profession, and here it is. And then happiness and sustainability, all these issues wrapped together. And I sat down and I went, wow, this is absolutely fantastic, the way he's putting it together. And it was fun to work on the film. He probably rejected 98 out of 100 ideas that I had. And very nicely, I had. And afterwards I went, good idea, you rejected all those ideas. Because I was always trying to push more into the film, and he said, hey, a film, you just can't cover everything like that. So I found a lot of wisdom in the way he worked, and it was a lot of fun to work with John. And then I just wanted to say a brief note on Holden. I was actually trained, I went to PLU and as a geologist, an earth science major, and I worked as a geologist at the Centralia coal mine in Centralia, Washington. And I was not happy with that at all. And in fact, just to kind of introduce part of the issues of sustainability, we had 10 seams of coal in that mine, and they only mined 3. And one of them was the bottom seam. So 7 seams of coal were totally wasted, just mixed with overburden and everything else. And the little tiny geology department, we went, well, this just doesn't make sense. So we did a life of the mine calculation. And you could either have the mine last for about 140 years, or about 40 years if you only mine 3 seams and waste 7. And the accounting group came back from the coal mine and said, oh, well, we make 1% more profit by mining the 3 best coal seams than if we mined all 10. And that just didn't add up for me. I said, well, yeah, 1% over 40 years versus, you know, 1% less over 140 years. But of course, we didn't get our way at all. And so I wasn't too happy. I liked the people I worked with. And I decided, that's it, I'm changing careers. This is not for me. And I came here to Holden to work on the winter staff. And that was way back in 1985. And reading Herman Daly's books, who was an ecological economist and such, I decided, that's it. Even though I'd only had one economics course, I'm going into economics. So we went down there to study in graduate school. So Holden had kind of a profound effect on me. I feel it's a very special place to come back to, and I think it is fulfilled for many people, as it has for me, a very special role. So I just kind of wanted to recognize that while I was here. But let's think about economics and sustainability. And I wanted to even start out with saying, you know, economics is about choices, where we put resources, how we allocate things, how we distribute them. So that's pretty important. And if you think in a grand scheme too, you know, this, we all have this stewardship. This is God's creation. And one of the pieces, I mean, each one of us are allocated this body, blood, a life is a gift. And these are our resources to take for our lives and do things with. And that is something you don't have to pay for. It's a gift. And so when we talk about our markets and how nature fits together, I'm going to talk a little bit about how God's gifts of nature fit with our economy, and that comes all around to sustainability. Well, one of the little, and if you think about it, everything that we have out of the built economy came out of nature. So whether it's glass or steel or plastic from cars, all these chairs, the wood around us, the stone, all came from nature, and that's what builds physically our economies. And think about the things we don't have to pay for that nature provides. For example, the breathable air example. And I always do this as an experiment, and it's fun because it doesn't matter whether you've got the Chamber of Commerce in the room. In fact, we did this experiment with a group of 70 people on a steering committee in Raya 9, which is the Green River watershed between Seattle and 16 cities, and they were all fighting about salmon restoration and various things. And you had the Chamber of Commerce and Audubon and Master Builders Association, and people who don't agree on anything just about. And so I did the vote, and I said, well, would you rather have one ecosystem service and good, the service is photosynthesis, and the good is oxygen, or would you rather have all your stuff, all your built capital? And so we always take a vote, and I think we should have a vote here. How many would vote for oxygen? Go ahead and raise your hand. And how many would vote for stuff? In fact, we'll just throw Bill Gates' stuff. Any votes for stuff? Well, it's kind of interesting, because you can even follow up with that and say, well, what about social capital? Would you rather have all Bill Gates' stuff, or, and no friends and family, or social capital and togetherness and belonging and so the social capital? So would you rather have your friends and family or all your stuff? How many would vote for friends and family? And how many would vote for stuff? Once in a while we have somebody that we have to send to the psychologist. But, and then the same with health. Think about that, your health. How much would you pay for a heart that worked if you had one that doesn't work? Well, probably quite a lot. So if you had a choice between a body that functions well or all Bill Gates' stuff, a brain and a heart that work, how many would vote for that health piece? And how many would vote for stuff? Well, what's interesting is that those things are sort of free gifts of nature, you might say, or our society as we've built it, and they're worth a huge amount. And think about where markets play their role. And I'm really a market economist, in truth. I love markets because they do just produce like shoes and clothing and toys and asphalt and things like that that we do use and need, and it's important. On the other hand, there's an economy of nature and sustainability, which is crucial. So think about oxygen. What if, I mean, our GDP, wouldn't we be better off if we actually just made oxygen rather than let the planet do it? I mean, the GDP would go up. You'd have a whole industry. You'd have jobs, you know, producing oxygen. On the other hand, you couldn't produce it for free. Nature produces oxygen in abundance, sustainably across how many generations? Reliably? I mean, if we had an oxygen blackout for a half hour, we'd all be in trouble, right? So we wouldn't want that. It's more reliable than any of our other production systems, in fact. And it's distributed equitably. We don't, unless you're really on the top of Mount Everest or underneath the ocean, you have free access to oxygen. So the fact is that the economy of nature in oxygen production outproduces any market economy that we could possibly have. So we need to think about where natural systems really do the best job. And it's a lot of areas: flood protection, storm protection, recreation, relaxation, contribution to spirituality, culture, water, food. The list goes on and on. We've identified kind of 23 categories of ecosystem services, and just in recreation, you'd have boating, fishing, biking, hiking, you know, etc., which are really important. And when you think about it, in the film, we brought up the four sort of capitals. Now, of course, every economy is built out of a balance, just like a good life, a good quality of life is built out of balance. We need some built capital. We certainly need, you know, transportation, we need cooking utensils, the energy, etc. We also need our human community. We need our social capital. And we need human health. We need our skills, education. We know that people have a higher quality of life with greater education. And we need our natural capital. So it's a balance of these things that really give us the greatest benefits. And another point is that every economy is changing. And so if you looked back on the 1930s, well, we created the GDP because we weren't producing enough stuff. There were a lot of Americans that didn't have indoor plumbing. There were a lot of Americans that were hungry, actually. I mean, it was really a tough period. And even prior to the 1930s, home ownership was very, very low in the United States, individual home ownership. So the GDP focused on producing things. And if you needed more fish, for example, in the 1930s, more salmon, we needed more boats and nets. We needed more built capital. But today, we have enough nets and boats. We're not really, if you need more fish, we're not short of what the human capital component is for producing fish. We're short of fish. We're actually short of habitat that produces fish. We're not really short of chainsaws and logging trucks anymore. We're short of trees, actually. And we're not short of systems to get water piped to people, like in Phoenix, etc. We're short of water. And so scarcity has really changed over time. And think about that with community also. You know, I think community is such a critical thing. And what Americans are saying is, I want more time. Time is scarce now, not stuff. In fact, my connection with my family, the time I spend with my family and friends, that's short. And that's why I think John's vision with the film was so brilliant, because so many of these things, health, etc., are bigger priorities for us today. So sustainability, when we think about it, just think about the period we live in. I mean, we've got a lot of threats on environment. And I won't go down the whole litany of crisis, like the climate crisis, toxics. Just burning coal creates a huge amount of mercury, let alone the CO2 and such. Land use, loss of habitat, endangered species, the list goes on and on. And I think one of the problems of the environmental movement has been, unlike Martin Luther King, who came out with a huge problem and said, he came out and said, I have a dream, much of the environmental movement has a little bit been, I have a nightmare. And it's not too attractive on that side. And we are confronted with this. But I think we also have to think, and so when we think about economies, one of the things we want to say about sustainability is the economy we have is physically, the evidence is pretty well in, not sustainable. So not everybody in the world can consume like Americans consume. And even Americans can't keep consuming like we're consuming. We are really confronted. As a geologist, peak oil is sort of a no-brainer. But we're not confronting those issues. Like Louisiana, think about the oil spill in Louisiana. What do you guys think about the oil spill and kind of the impact of the oil spill? I think it's kind of a 911 moment for the United States, certainly in the South. I lived 5 years in Louisiana, and it's like an atom bomb dropping in the Gulf for the people who live there. I mean, it's really, the impact is frightening for a huge number of people. And we just released a report on it, and it echoes, I think, some elements of real transformation in our economy. The 20th century was really about producing more stuff, and we did it with a oil-based economy, and we're going to have to make some changes on that basis. But I think one of the important things is our vision, that I have a green vision. What is the desirable economy that we want? And I think the economy that we have today, we can say, actually, we've got a lot of improvement to go. And it's actually not desirable to have more plastic toys and asphalt is our economy is really geared to build, how many people have too few plastic toys? How many people have enough plastic toys in their house? You know, the typical American family with kids gets 63 more plastic toys every year. And in our house, it seems like they just gravitate to us. Everybody gives us plastic toys, and we just end up with more. So I think it's really important for us to reflect on what is scarce and what is not scarce. And another thing I want to mention is that we look at this often. We take economic transformation, you might say, and all these issues, more spare time, happiness, this pursuit. We say, oh my gosh, you can't change it. This economy is so big. How could we ever change from oil and start moving on to other resources? It's just so tremendous. And yet, that's all economies do. No economy sits still. Economies transform. That's all we do. In fact, every 20, 30 years, we pretty much rip everything out of all the buildings in Seattle and put new stuff in. We build new transportation systems. It's been a lot more pavement has been our pursuit for the last few years, but we rip up almost all the roads and put down new pavement within a 30-year period. And so, in fact, the easiest thing to transform, facing limits to growth and other things, is really the economy. I mean, if there's one thing that you don't want to try and transform, it's the climate. That's big. That's a matter of hundreds of years or thousands of years, potentially. There's the one thing we don't want to mess up. It's probably the climate, because it's more difficult to change than our energy systems for an economy. And the U.S. has already had good practice in this. I mean, we had, between 1934 and 1944, and it was a combination of the Depression, the New Deal, the World War II, but that whole combination of new banking laws, new laws in agriculture, manufacturing, just right down the line to really transform our economy, and then this massive push of investment and a huge shift in investment actually transformed our economy in 10 years. Mm. It's rather mind-boggling to think about it. What the U.S. economy was in 1934 and what it became in 1940. And today, we have far more capacity than we had in 1934. Way more capacity. Think about it. We're almost at an apex of human, you know, habitation on the planet. We have more people than ever. We have more energy resources. We have more wealth. We have more investment. We have more education. We have more understanding. And these environmental problems, you know, you go down the list of 20 problems, we're not in a position where we were during the Black Plague in the 1300s, where people didn't know what was killing them off. Actually, we know the solutions to these problems. There's green building. There's renewable energy, there's efficiency. For virtually every single problem, we actually have identified the solutions. I mean, that's rather stunning, I think. And you have all these kind of specialized organizations. So I think our position of hope is immense. But, like our situation in the 1930s, we actually have to take action. We really have to make a difference. So I think one of the questions is, are we at a place where we were in the 1930s? We actually are in a situation of limits to growth. And is what we want to do work more hours and consume more stuff? Is that where we want to go, the economy of the 20th century? You know, toward the end of the 20th century, more working hours? Or is the economy where we want to go less stuff, more time with our friends and family? How many feel that what they really need to make their quality of life better is more stuff? Anybody feel they need a lot more stuff? Here's one. Okay, good. Ron? Okay. Well, that's not too many. Maybe we need a little redistribution in that direction. Nancy's laughing. Maybe you think you need more stuff, Nancy? Yeah, Ron, what do you need? You're putting me on the spot.
Well, I lost $100 bill this morning, but people here were happy. And by the way, I found it. I did find it.
Yeah, and the issue of justice is very, very important, because there are so many. I was in Ethiopia some time ago. And there are a lot of people who do need more things. In fact, there's a huge portion of the population that $100 a year would translate. transformed their lives. It really transformed their lives. Yep.
I don't feel I need more stuff, but there are things that I worry about, like paying for my kids' college education, or wanting to make sure they can have music lessons or play sports, which all costs money. And so those are a little more intangible, but we're still working just as hard as we can to ensure those things, and they're good things, right? You know, it
That's
doesn't
right.
have a negative connotation that more stuff does, but at least for people in my generation, I see that happen a lot.
I agree, and you know, this is again, very, very important point, because it's how our economy allocates goods and services. So, for example, in a lot of European countries, education is provided through more government funding and through a different tax system. And is it? And I think it's important for. I went on to a career in nonprofit work, and I couldn't have done that, I think, if I had a huge debt from college. Fortunately, I had some scholarships and fellowships, whatever. I made it without a huge debt. But you know, you think about how debt limits. That's a whole nother issue that we should talk about, but I think is the only solution that we have to have one system for providing, for instance, college education and sports, even sport access to sports. In the 1940s, sports was available without a great deal of cost, but it was centered around communities in a different sort of way. But anyway, I won't.
David, obviously you got almost unanimous opinion on each of your questions here. And you said, which is interesting, that in a group of people representing maybe very different kinds of orientations and business and so forth, you get the same responses. So on the one hand, you get this sort of universal response of a kind of wisdom about where we are and what we really need as compared to what we don't need. And yet, there's something in the way. It doesn't happen. And so I'm hoping you're going to address that to some extent. I mean,
that's exactly where I'm going.
Okay.
And it's economics and the economy.
Okay, I have a couple of comments. One is similar to what she said. But I mean, even if you don't, people often have to work long hours only to keep what they have. You know, it's not that you were working so hard because you want a bigger house, but that if you don't, you will not be able to pay the mortgage on the house you have. You'll lose health insurance.
Precisely.
I don't know if I need more stuff, but I do need more money. I'm working with a startup company, and we need to raise capital. We need investment. We need money. And
we need to give ourselves
an opportunity. Also, on a personal level, you know, you need things come up, and it seems like even if you make a decent amount of money, that there's so many boxes that you can put in that are a very small part of our family income is spent on buying. I mean, like, stuff is cheap. Plastic toys are cheap.
Right.
You know,
exactly
the mortgage
right.
costs a lot of money. The insurance costs a lot of money. Our money goes towards things that don't feel like you're amassing more stuff. It goes to stuff. It goes towards stuff that is like, well, you know, this, you know, towards what feels like necessary expenses.
And like college education,
yes,
that's
exactly.
part of capacity. That's part of building your human capital and really giving
opportunities for your kids. My child has had some trouble in school and actually spent a fairly large amount of money trying to get him more adjusted, I guess.
And that'll probably make
a
huge difference for his quality of life.
Yeah.
But you've done that. Well, I think these two questions are very closely connected. Because in truth, I think what transforms an economy, what makes the difference, is investment, where you put investment. And this is why I think, for a number of reasons, we need to think carefully, because we are an immensely wealthy nation. It's surprising how wealthy the United States is. And should we have college education that costs what it costs, in fact, if we allocated our resources a bit differently? And the same thing with an innovative startup company, you know, we should be actually be transitioning very quickly toward innovation that reduces our ecological footprint and the unsustainability of our economy and increases the strength of communities. There are all kinds of elements there with, you know, how communities are designed, which in fact comes back to sports and whether you have the fields and the ability there, and you can even reduce those costs as well. But think about this, in the 1930s, and really the core, I think, is investment, where we put our resources and how we decide as a society to do that and what rules we place. So in the 1930s, companies, one of the biggest changes, which is kind of below the radar generally of what we think of Social Security and some of the big changes that took place, is the FDR went to the Social Security and Exchange Commission and said, we're going to change all the rules here. Because prior to those changes, any company could report anything they liked. So even if your company was tanking, you could report great profits. And so it was kind of up to investors to try and figure out what was actually happening. And finally, with the SEC, you know, FDR said, that's it. You have to report these things, and if you report them incorrectly, you go to jail, period. And that probably did more to shift investment in the United States right during the 1930s and into the 40s than almost anything else, even more than expenditures on World War II, because finally people knew where expenses should go. And one of the important things about that, and this is actually in a different chapter, sustainability, it's on the economic, the financial crisis, but I'll just mention it here, is that they tried to divide two things, speculation from investment. Speculation is when I'm putting money out there and my basic goal is to cream some money off of everybody else. I'm not producing any goods and services, but I expect to get a return for my money. So currency trading is a kind of a great example of that. In currency trading, I don't produce any good or service. And George Soros is the first one to say that. And in fact, he said it should be banned. It would be the best thing, but as long as they don't ban it, he'll do it. But anyway, so currency trading, I don't actually arbitrage. I don't produce a good or service, but I skim a tiny bit of value off of everybody else who's holding the currencies that are in increase or decline. Okay? And so one proposal is put a tiny currency tax on, and you'd completely eliminate that. But there are a whole kind of series of activities in that speculative category. How much money is going there? About $2 trillion a day. Only in currency trading. That's it. Just in currency trading. What if you freed that money up for other investments, you know, for startup companies that are actually going to produce good and services? Or if you free that up, also you can reduce the interest rate or the cost on college, whether you're borrowing for it or actually having college, and things like that. So we have this massive amount of investments which are going to the wrong places. And we need to reorient to that. And that's part of the transition to sustainability. If you don't get the rules right for steering investment, it will go in the wrong direction. And we had the worst example of that with the financial crisis. So anyway, I wanted to come back a little bit toward ecosystem services and just mention about a few things about how fundamentally looking at natural systems and their sustainability and what they provide affects us. Well, right now you're in Washington State, and one thing I love about Washington State is its constitution was written during the populist period. And so Washington State said, we want the closest government to people is the best thing. And as a result of that, we have so many tax districts. So parks are their separate tax district. Often they're not connected to the city. They're separate with a separate board of directors and such. We have shellfish districts, park districts, stormwater districts, port districts, you know, and the list goes on and on. But one of the things that's come around is that every time we lose an ecosystem service, something that was provided by nature for free, by well-functioning natural systems, we need a new tax district to fix the problem. So we used to have, you know, water conveyance provided by natural systems, but as we paved everything over, now we need a stormwater district. We used to have shellfish that were perfectly healthy and fine on their own in a nice, clean Puget Sound, but as the water quality of Puget Sound declined, now we need a shellfish district to try and regulate the quality of water. And as flooding became a problem, then we need a flood district to build levees. And so if you look at just one district, I mean, this is a surprising set of facts. Well, let me ask this question. If anybody have a wild guess at how many tax districts are in just one water watershed in Washington State, the Green River watershed, which is, includes Seattle and 16 cities up to Black Diamond. Any guess on how many tax districts are there?
50.
That's a good guess. Over 150. Over 150 tax districts. So then we have what I would call infrastructure conflict. So you have stormwater, 16 stormwater districts just in that one, and that of course would include police, 911 districts, health, all kinds of things. But anyway, 16 stormwater districts, all building stormwater systems to get that water out of, you know, Auburn, out of Kent, out of Seattle, into the river as fast as possible. And then you have one flood district down at the bottom going, gee, peak floods are going up every year. We've got more flooding every year. Kind of catastrophic. And so then they have to build the levees higher. So we need more taxes to build the levees higher. And then you have a salmon restoration group, Ryan Nye, which has to invest in salmon restoration. So part of our problem in thinking about efficiency, it's not always that going to sustainability is going to cost more. In fact, it's going to cost less, most likely in many areas, and we're going to get greater benefit out of it. So we proposed to the 16 cities, this is Earth Economics, forming a sort of a watershed investment district, which would include all of the stormwater districts, drinking water, salmon restoration, and flood protection. And the cities have basically said, yes, we want to pursue this because we want to integrate stormwater, flood protection, et cetera, because it's actually would be in the interest of the flood district to pay the cities a bit to say, hold your stormwater up, put that water into the groundwater, recharge our drinking water, and you'll have more water in the summer for salmon in our creeks. So it's one integrated system, and so we need one integrated approach. And to their credit, they're moving in this direction pretty quickly. And it came, actually, the first meeting we had, which was 5 years ago, we did that experiment with the group that had the chambers of commerce and all, and it was the first time they all voted and looked around and went, hey, we all voted unanimously. But they started a lot of unanimous votes because one of the critical things there was a salmon restoration project called the North Winds Weir. And about half of the steering committee said, this is, what are we doing? Spending $5 million for a few salmon? This is kind of a bad project. It would put these, it's right in the portion of the river where salmon have to spend 2 weeks to go from fresh to salt water and out to the ocean. Right now it's like a pipe with a levee and they're just pushed right into the salt water. And in fact, by restoring it, you put these off little sloughs and off river channels. And so what we said was, well, let's look at the flood protection benefit of that. And so we calculated, because you're slowing the water down, it kind of slows down and stirs around there, and in fact there's a big bend in the Green River down below. So you're slowing it down and you're protecting the levee downstream. And so we calculated the value of that, and it was about $100 million just in probably savings for the levee. And suddenly the Master Builders Association and Boeing and others went, wow, let's have about 10 more of these salmon restoration projects. You can put these things together. So I think when we come to sustainability and the economy and investment, we want to think about, you know, what is really providing a higher quality of life, what are ways we invest where we get education at a more reasonable cost, and healthcare can be provided, and things like that. And where are we shifting out of an economy that wasn't working so much? And we just completed a report on the Gulf of Mexico. And I think, you know, it's very interesting. We are in a time of tremendous transition. And if you were a British citizen or others, you'd think that investing in an oil company is about the best investment you can have, because our economy is based on oil, and they're always going to be using oil. But it's turned out that maybe it's not such a good investment anymore, because now oil companies are out there in very risky areas drilling where they don't know the full implications. In fact, incompetence was probably involved as well with this spill. And personally, I don't think BP, even though it's the biggest company in the UK, is going to survive this spill, because if they aren't held accountable for the costs, it's going to be larger than the $100 billion that they're worth. And that's a very, it's, the writing is on the table for the costs of this spill. And so I think that in that transition, we need to really think about that investment that we've placed in oil infrastructure, and they're putting more oil. In fact, there's a simulation that my colleagues are doing now to say basically the Deep Horizon oil rig is where we're putting our currently cheap oil to build this giant construction to drill for oil, and is it even on an energy scale, is it worth it? Probably not. It would have been better to invest that money in another energy resource where we're actually going to get more energy out of it for a longer run than we would with the Deep Horizon. And so these are kind of the kind of considerations that we need to really start making. A couple other things I wanted to just ask you all about. You know, I think it's been a wonderful movement within the Lutheran Church and other interfaith organizations, you know, to start thinking about sustainability. And Paul, his question the other day is, with this information, you know, what shall I do? How do I act? What do I do? And I think that is a wonderful question, to think about our participation and how what we do has an impact on the whole large piece. And I volunteered for a while for the Philippine Rural Reconstruction Movement, which was really fun and a great education for me, because there you deal with real poverty. Like one of the things my wife and I, we sat back and went, you know, all of us in the United States, if you've had a college education, if you can afford a car or a house, we're among the world's wealthiest, and that's where we are. And I think we need to reflect more on that and think about that piece. It's important to think about that. We have the most dollars for consumer sovereignty to lay down, and where those dollars go, we get the economy that we're placing them for. And that, I think, is another piece of investment. That each dollar you spend is an investment in the future economy or kind of the past economy, and it's really worthy of considering that. But how many folks here are, you know, part of either the Earth Ministry or your churches or the Interfaith Power and Light? Have you heard of those organizations? So not too many. I'm kind of surprised. They're out there. But I think that the issue of sustainability is really growing in a lot of churches. And I think, I don't know, how do you all feel about kind of the role of the church and sustainability? And these things are so woven together, it's sort of hard to separate. But
church has to set the example.
Church has to set the example. I think that's a great idea.
That's what
because the church is involved with kind of to the point now where it's really trying to hang on to itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's trying to sustain itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the more actually the church ties to these issues, like I think John, watching audiences see the film, it's amazing how it resonates, the issue of happiness, the issue of distribution and equality and fairness. So I think these are the true call. This is part of the calling of the church as well. Our stewardship. But Ron, you had a comment?
Yeah, no, I mean, our church does a lot around this, and it's so, there's so many levels to it, and that's one of the most exciting things. I mean, it's from, you know, personal practices to, you know, to how your, you know, church lighting works and your toilets and all that, you know, a garden, we have a community garden, and, you know, how that relates to outreach in the neighborhood, to, you know, education of the kids in the garden, and, you know, it's just woven, you know, through the life of, and then how that relates to worship, and then public policy. So mm-hmm. So it goes, you know, from, you know, the most macro to the, you know, most micro kind of stuff in a congregation. And I think it's a, and it also bridges generations, and it bridges political, you know, perspectives too. But we found this kind of work on sustainability can cross sort of traditional political lines.
And I think the sustainability and the growth of the progressive church, of the Lutheran Church and others, are tied to these issues very closely. They really are, and I say that because out of our history too. I mean, it was the progressive churches that fought against slavery, that said women should have a vote, that said, you know, that even on income tax, the churches had a position on these issues. And I think we need to consider that again, how important it is for the church to be so alive in what is happening for people today. I think debt is a really crucial case for college, for houses, for things like I would reflect on, you know, I look at my grandparents' house and the house that I grew up in and such, and why is it that we have to have a bigger house? And in fact, my wife knew I do have a bigger house than my parents had. And we, in fact, we lived at one time in a 600 square foot house. And it was so cute. It was like this big from the corner. And we could clean the whole thing in one day. And then we're all done. and we both kind of reminisce and go, now, why did we move into this bigger place? You know, and such. Of course, the kid, when Raphael was born, that crying was almost a little too close sometimes. But I think that we do need to reflect on even the houses that we have. It can be even set back to a smaller, a lot smaller house and a lot less costly. We have some friends who, Marlene and Don, and they were moving from kind of a large house into a really small house. And I said, Marlene, how come you're moving? And she said, see that room? I cleaned it 12 times last year and we sat in it once. And I think this is, you know, and then I had to have all this furniture. I'm getting rid of all this stuff. And that's and so I think, you know, back to more basics.
I don't want to sound too pessimistic about this whole thing. Yeah. But I think I came to Holden first in 1983, and I've also spent 3 years on staff here in the late 80s and early 90s. And I've listened to much the same thing since then. And I've also heard that the churches can do something about it. And then I attend a session yesterday from Chris, and he tells me that, and I believe it, that the traditional church is actually disappearing, and presumably will eventually disappear, which may not be a bad thing because you have to die in order to live. But we don't seem to have improved things over the last 30 years. And I wonder what's going to make the difference for us to improve them. And we know what to do, but we can't do it.
I think we have made some changes, Robert. I mean, I think, you know, how you'd measure that, I mean, you would need to get, you know, to really look at, you know, everything from people's sort of lifestyle choices to public policy things. And I think the environmental movement and the state and the churches have been part of that, through Earth Ministry and... that, you know, we have won some victories, you know, on toxics, for example, and, you know, and if you look at some of the changes in environmental policy in the state of Washington that that have been for the better, that the churches have played a role in that, you know, maybe, I mean, you have to say, okay, we have really strong secular environmentalists here, but, you know, but the churches have done their part, too, so I think it's...
There's a comment on this.
Yeah, it's a... I serve a church in Northwest Portland, and we found, kind of to our surprise, that these very issues of sustainability and stewardship of the world were the meeting place between our congregation and an extremely secular setting. I mean, the least church state in the country and all. We put sidewalk signs out for some Northwest Earth Institute courses, and we had people come off the street to sit around table with us. So. To me, it's part of the rebirth of the church. It's part of our outreach and our partnership. I mean, if those folks never come to worship with us, okay, but we've developed a partnership that's actually changing people's habits and people's lives. I mean, they came because it was a burning issue for them. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to return for just a moment to the stuff issue. There's no question that many people collect more stuff, but it seems to me that another issue of sustainability is the cost of stuff. I went to St. Olaf in 1958, and the comprehensive fee was $1,200 for a year. My father was an executive and made about $15,000 a year, so that represented, let's say, 10% of his annual income. Now, if you go to St. Olaf, I think the comprehensive fee is around $45,000. And that doesn't include all the beer and pizza that it and that would be far more than 10% of the average, you know, person's annual income. 100%. So how does, you know, if this keeps increasing like that, I don't know how we sustain that. And is there any hope that could change the cost? And perhaps impressed with some folks who said, you know, it isn't that I buy more plastic toys, but
right.
I can't afford my kids' lessons. You know, I'm retired now. The cost of a supplemental health insurance and medical expenses is huge, more than lots of people can afford. So they just don't have it. They don't have something else. So when they bring their Medicare card, they still have to pay a huge amount of co-pays and other costs. So what can we do? What is happening? Can the cost of stuff change in our economy, or is it just inevitable that it's coming out of control?
Well, I think, again, this comes back to allocation of resources. And I think there are two places where we can work. One is and they really have to be parallel. We have to work on both sides. One is individually and how we decide to spend our budgets and what we do and how we allocate. That's very important. And second is society, how society works. And the United States, I mean, Washington State has had 102 amendments to the Constitution. And the rules of the economy, again, govern where we spend things. And our elected officials decide we've spent over $2 trillion in Iraq. How far would $2 trillion have gone to reduce education expenses or medical care, or provide free medical care for Americans? I mean, we have chosen to allocate our resources in a certain way. We spend more on defense than the next 10 countries combined. And so this is really, economics is about choices and how we allocate resources. And these are decisions that we have to make as Americans and as a society. And it's two pieces, how the society spends it and how we spend it. Just to get to your question about those costs, I gave a talk in India and was fortunate enough to be able to bring my kids over, and Isabel came over. And it was quite a trip. And at one point, we were in this little place looking at some birds with binoculars. These little kids ran out. And I always show them through the binoculars. They didn't ask for money or anything, but one had horribly infected finger. And so we said, oh my gosh, let's take him to the clinic. So we took him to the clinic. The guy scrubbed out his injury with no anesthetics. And the kid just flinched with pain, but wanted his finger fixed. Worked on it for a half hour. Gave him antibiotics, gave him a penicillin shot, etc. Cost $1.06. But one of the things is that India does not allow patenting of a lot of medicines. So you can go ahead and produce a lot of medicines. And I think there's some very important issues about how we allocate rights and ownership. And one ecological economist we work with, I mean, basically, if you create a pharmaceutical, you should get a benefit. You should get a royalty. But why should one company get the right to be the only company to manufacture that? So in other words, if like Taxol for breast cancer cure, if you said, okay, the inventor of Taxol gets a royalty, they get a payment, but any company can manufacture it. The information is free with a royalty charge. The price of those pharmaceuticals could go way, way down. But we've decided that we're going to give monopoly control over that one thing. Now think about a mathematician. And this is a very important issue because think about a mathematician. My dad's a mathematician who taught at PLU, but they created all the derivatives and differential equations that we use on computers. But you know, you don't patent those, and mathematicians still work on them and produce them. If they did patent them, you know, one penny per calculation on a computer, they'd be quite wealthy. But in fact, it was better that we didn't allow patenting of differential equations, because mathematicians have a wider exchange of information. And so these are very fundamental questions in our economy, which I think one path of greater monopoly, and this is part of what Adam Smith argued against, monopoly control. One path says we're going to really concentrate wealth and give certain monopoly rights, which are going to make everything a lot more costly. And another path says we're going to do things a bit differently, which we've done in other parts of our society. So I just open that as a discussion. See, one here and here.
Okay, I have some knowledge in the farming industry, but the path to drug discovery and development is really long. It takes 15 years, 20 years. So that's their justification, is that it takes a huge amount of investment, and it's extremely risky, because you can have a 20-year project that goes bust when the FDA doesn't approve your drug, or it has nasty effects. But so
So you still deserve an income out of that.
Yeah, but it's very risky and very expensive. Okay. So if you want to lower, they only go through it because of the potential huge payoff. So if you make the payoff less, you're going to have to also, on the other hand, subsidize some of the discovery or something like that.
Which is true, and I think actually much of the discovery is subsidized because a lot of the research takes place in universities.
But I think that you're going to have to even more so because they don't perceive so that the risk doesn't seem to grace them. But that whole blockbuster model is also shaking out. They won't be able to float on that too much longer.
Mm-hmm. I think so, but I think again, a company does deserve return. And so even with Taxol, you get a royalty, so they get a return. But why do we give them monopoly for production of that drug just to one company? When in fact, and it might not even be the company that produced the drug. They may just purchase it, like Immunex was an example that, where it just bought off by another company, and then they hold the monopoly patent on it. So then that's kind of a delicate economic argument. But yeah, the person who originates it, like a film, deserves to get a fair return. But what we've done is say we're going to make a monopoly on the actual company that produces the drug.
Yeah.
And that has increased costs, I think, much further than even would be required to pay the development costs.
It only lasts for a certain period. After that, it's open season. So
17
years.
Well, plus
17
years,
which is a pretty long time.
Yeah.
And for software, you know, it's like it might as well be centuries because it's all obsolete by 17 years.
Happening more and more is that workers are squeezed, you know, threatened that if they don't work harder and harder, they'll lose their job. And the reality is that they will lose their job if they don't work harder and harder. And then there are fewer jobs for other people. And, you know, efficiency in terms of economic efficiency then, you know, helps the company to thrive, but it doesn't help the workers to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just see this happening in so many ways. And then the idea that you need a new drug for toenail fungus. If you don't subsidize it, we won't have it, and the economy won't work, and we won't have enough people working. You know, I see it as a systemic thing, and I think, you know, we can tinker around the edges, but I look at it and I really do despair. I feel like it is so stacked in that way, and the squeeze is on. You know, so what about?
Well, I think that's a great point. It shows a couple things. One, even with the pharmaceutical industry, if you're going to get more money out of toenail fungus, you know, relief, then forget tuberculosis.
Yes, exactly.
Because people with tuberculosis don't have money.
Well,
they,
exactly.
Tuberculosis
is
so closely tied with malnutrition and such. So I think that's a very good point. And this is why, you know, if you look at economic transition, and I think economies, they need a jolt at some point where you really have to have a big transition. It probably means more government involvement for a while, or changing of rules so that the right things are rewarded again. And it's really, that piece means, like the New Deal in the Depression, I mean, we changed the rules for Wall Street and investment shifted enormously. And that's probably the quickest way to change investment. And then we had government expenditures, even with World War II, that really shifted the economy. And you had big changes. And then you had a huge set of legislation that went everything from banking to manufacturing to education to nature, natural systems and national parks, even in the 40s, and right down the line. And that gave a new structure, we would say, for the economy, a new basis for the structure. And this is sort of where we have to go. And I don't despair because I don't think it's that hard. And if you want another example, and it's, you know, kind of a mind, China is quite an example. It's gone the wrong way. It's gone a 20th century path. But in 1990, China was 1/10 the size of the Soviet Union, the economy. Now, then by 2000, it was 10 times the size. Why? What did that change? What made that change? They had a set of policies, and they said, we're going to promote industrial development, period. And they called in basically investment from the planet. A huge amount of U.S. investment went into China, into those industries, and that's what changed things. And just on the, I guess we're at the end of our time. But I wanted to say something about the workers.
The difference is they can decide that in a day. When the top says we're going this direction, they go. You got a democracy that has special interests and you know, to fight the oil company is huge.
We did it, though.
Have a tax.
We've done
gasoline,
it.
You just can't get it done.
I don't agree. You know, in Washington State, if you look at the tax proposals for increased taxes, starting right at the financial crisis in 2008, most have passed. Amazing. Whether it's school districts or park districts or various other taxes, they've passed. Even the tax on candy, etc., and pop. And one of the curious things is people's knee-jerk reaction is economic crisis taxes won't go through. But actually, our history is almost the opposite. The 1930s, that's when we got the most tax changes. And I think part of it is people's mentality, the majority, not the vocal minority, that in fact, we need to come together as a community and we need to make some changes. And so I think that I think we need to be more bolder than actually we've been and test the waters of change of those changes. And I think most Americans, just like the impact of the Gulf War on a huge population of the American public, that are saying, yeah, we need to get off war oil, otherwise we're going to be in more wars.
David, see, one of the things that I have thought sometime about strategy is identifying an issue where there is potential for change because of a certain context and a certain timeliness of it, and it is a change which carries us as far further toward where we want to go than other changes would. It seems to me that in looking ahead to the November election and the BP oil spill, it'll be very helpful if environmental groups like yours, the Interfaith group, were able to or would come forward with an issue, a change that should be demanded that could potentially have bipartisan support related somehow to the oil spill that would carry us forward with a kind of a jolt, not to where we want to go, but further than a lot of little battles that we might want.
I agree. I think one of them might be ending a constitutional amendment to end corporate campaign contributions. That might be one piece. But on the environment as well, I think there has to be a target of saying we're going to reduce oil consumption in the country by X amount. Because, I mean, Louisiana produces 16% of the oil it produced in 1968. I mean, we're just sliding down as fast as we can on oil production in this country. And these deep oil drills, even the horizon is not going to add anything appreciable to that.
Just to wrap up here tomorrow, for anyone who wants to, we're going to be kind of talking about the range of solutions and some of the things that we might do in the conversation. Also, for any of you who would like to see Dave's smiling face on the screen in a different context, today at 3 p.m. We'll be showing the film The Whole World Was Watching, which is a 30-minute film I did just at the end of last year, which looks back after 10 years at the WTO protests in Seattle and talks to people from all sides on that about what that accomplished and what it did. And one of the people we talked to is Dave, who is one of the leaders of the protests in 1999. So I invite you to that if you want to come at 3 o'clock and see a little more of Dave. And,
you can tolerate
it. And then for anybody who wants to see the film Affluenza, it is showing tonight at 8:30 also here. So,
and I guess my final wrap-up thought just in response to your question is actually the easiest thing to shift of all is really investment. And I spent 20 years actually working on World Bank investment from the outside. We had a group of coalition, about 300 nonprofit groups from all over the world. And you know, their funding was pushed toward greater education and health. They still do damaging funding, etc. But investment is the easiest thing, most rapid thing that we can change. And it's actually where investment goes today, that's the economy you have in 30 years that it builds it. And so I think, you know, we haven't thought about it, but the environmental movement and kind of social justice movement, we need to think about what rules shift investment in the right direction on a very large scale. And there's a lot of investment out there that has been burned already, and they're actually looking for what's going to change. And that means a lot of the solutions we're going to talk about tomorrow.